Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law podcast for February 2009. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you will find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. When someone infringes a patent, he or she is usually liable for damages. One measure of damages is a reasonable royalty, sometimes measured by the royalty that would have been negotiated by a willing licensor and a willing licensee. For the successful plaintiff in an action for patent infringement, such a calculation can feel as though the defendant has obtained a license in circumstances where one might never have been granted. Even the early U.S. Patent Act recognized that such circumstances could be unfair to patentees and not deter potential infringers. Since 1800, the U.S. Patent Act has permitted a patentee to recover a sum equal to three times the actual damages sustained. In recent years, these enhanced damages have required a showing of willful infringement. In 2007, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit reconsidered the test for willful patent infringement in the case of In re Seagate, and things have not been the same ever since. To discuss Seagate and its aftermath, my guest for this podcast is Diane Elderkin, the chair of the Litigation Practice Services Group of the intellectual property law firm of Woodcock Washburn. Diane concentrates in trying patent infringement cases and is ranked as one of the top U.S. patent litigators by Chambers USA, the Best Lawyers in America Guide, the Legal 500, and the Pennsylvania Super Lawyers. Diane spoke with me from her office in Philadelphia. Good afternoon, Diane. Thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, Don.
Diane, I wonder if you could explain what was the test for willful infringement prior to the Seagate decision?
Okay, well, it was really mostly just set forth in the underwater devices case, which was from 1983. And what underwater devices held is if an accused infringer had knowledge of a patent that was being asserted against it, it really had an affirmative duty of care to investigate whether its action might infringe that patent and might infringe that patent if valid. So the burden, in a sense, was placed on the accused infringer if there were evidence that it had knowledge of the patent to come forward with evidence showing that it had a good faith belief for why the patent was either not valid or why it was not infringed by the accused infringer's activity. And absent that evidence, that was a key element for a court to look at in determining whether an accused infringer's activity were willful.
And I understand the Seagate decision has created a sea change in that test for willful infringement. What changes did the U.S. Court of Appeal for the Federal Circuit make to the test in Seagate?
Okay, well, it did away with the affirmative duty of care that was set forth in underwater devices, and it set forth a two-part test for willful infringement. The first part is there has to be an objectively high likelihood that the accused infringer's actions would constitute infringement of a valid patent. And again, this is an objective test. It's not subjective. It's not, well, what did this particular accused infringer know or do or understand? Just looking at this objectively, was there a high likelihood that what the infringer was doing would infringe a valid patent? So for that prong of the test, we can look at, well, does the accused infringer have strong non-infringement positions, strong invalidity positions, even if he or she didn't have those positions developed and didn't have them in mind when he or she started his accused activity? Then if the patentee can prove that there was an objectively high likelihood, then that's only the first part of the test. The second part of the test, you have to prove that that objective risk was known or should have been known to the accused infringer. So that's where we get to the subjective part of the test. What did that accused infringer understand? And this is where we would still look to things such as, well, did they have a good faith belief that their actions would be non-infringing or would not infringe a valid patent? So it's a two-prong test. Harder test to prove.
Now, these questions are going to be posed presumably at the end of trial when damages are going to be assessed and a determination made whether or not the defendant should have to pay enhanced damages. Is the first question almost answered in and of itself by the jury verdict that the defendant is guilty, or are there other considerations involved?
Well, a lot of this is still being worked out. Now, some judges bifurcate the issue of willfulness, and you don't try willfulness until it's already been determined that a patent was infringed and it hasn't been proven invalid. But lots of courts don't do that. So it's, believe me, it's still being worked out in a lot of courts how this can be proven. And for the first time, we're seeing summary judgment motions on willfulness. This is always hard to do in the past, to move for summary judgment of no willfulness or summary judgment of willfulness, because the question was always wrapped up in fact issues. And of course, when there are material issues of genuine fact, such as, well, was this opinion that was relied upon competent? Was it reasonably relied upon? And when there are issues of fact, you're not going to get summary judgment. Now, however, there are more summary judgment motions on willfulness happening, because the court is willing to look at the record just objectively and based on what is before the court at that point, which may just be the expert reports on infringement on validity, depositions and the like. The court will look, you know, there are close issues of infringement here. There are close issues of invalidity, or strong positions on infringement, strong positions on invalidity. So I'm going to rule as a matter of law, based on the record before me, that there could not be any objective recklessness here and do away with, dismiss this claim of willfulness. But how it gets to the jury is still something that's being worked out, because this is all quite new to us.
This is all showing up then a lot earlier in the lawsuit than it had beforehand. Is that right?
Frequently, right, on summary judgment motions, which come before trial, yes.
Has there been a shift in, if not the burden of proof, at least the onus of leading some evidence, where beforehand the defendant had a duty to investigate whether it might be infringing the patent? If that's gone away, is there a much higher onus now than on the plaintiff than there had been beforehand?
I think it's fair to say that. I mean, even though the burden of proof for proving willfulness has always been on the patentee who's alleging it, once the patentee could establish that accused infringer had knowledge of the patent and continued its accused activity in the face of that knowledge, the onus really did shift to the accused infringer to come forward with some evidence of how they had carried out their affirmative duty of care, how they had investigated the patent, and if they had reasonably come to a conclusion that what they were doing wasn't infringing a valid patent. Now, you don't even get to that until the patentee has overcome this rather high standard of proving objective recklessness. And my two cents is, since most of the cases that get to trial are close cases, you know, they're really strong cases, settle one way or the other. Most of the time when you get to trial, it's because there are close issues of validity, or there are close issues of infringement. It's probably more likely that the issue will get to the jury, but the patentee still has to overcome that probably on summary judgment before getting to trial.
I understand that Judge Newman expressed concern that the new test might encourage willful blindness. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, one of the problems that a lot of people had with the old standard was, you know, it's just a part of doing business. Companies have their people looking to see what their competitors are getting in the patent field. That just makes good sense. What's being published out there, so that we can build on that and learn from what other people are getting in their patents. And the concern was that you might have one person in your R&D department who's regularly looking at the new patents being issued, and so has a file that indicates they've looked at these patents. And that would be taken as evidence that your whole company somehow had knowledge of this patent. And boy, then what did you do to make sure that you weren't infringing it? Because now I've accused you of infringement. And it sort of went to extremes sometime. And so some companies were saying, well, gee, you know, the way we're going to deal with this, we're just going to put our blinders on and not see what our competitors are doing, which I think many people would say is a shame, and that's really having the tail wag the dog. And that's not what anybody intended the whole willfulness document or a doctrine to prevent. So Judge Newman commented on that in her concurring opinion, and she said, "I hope that this new standard is not going to have people basically willfully infringe patents, you know about patents, and get away with not taking some care to make sure that they're not infringing people's valid patents. And she uses some interesting language in her concurring opinion. She said, the standards of behavior by which a possible infringer evaluates adverse patents should be the standards of fair commerce, including reasonableness of the actions taken in the particular circumstances. And the majority opinion picks that line up, and they put it in a footnote in their majority opinion where they basically say, yeah, look, the standards of fair commerce have to apply here. So the way I read this is that they're saying, look, it's not going to be, you're not going to meet the standard for willfulness under this new Seagate standard if you're doing just what I just described. You know, somebody in your research department is following patents, and then lo and behold, it turns out that you may be infringing one of them, and nobody had ever really made the connection that there might have been a risk there. That we don't want to impose standards that keep people from doing what they need to do in their business. But let's be reasonable about it, but let's not also preclude the possibility that somebody really is being reckless and knows about patents and knows there should be a risk and or should have known that there should be a risk and proceeds anyway. That's the kind of behavior that we want to possibly preclude with this willfulness standard.
One of the comments made by the court was that a plaintiff in an infringement action should have a good faith basis for alleging willful infringement. Does that mean that patent owners should be seeking fairly detailed opinions on infringement before they have cease and desist letters or accusations of infringement go out?
I don't think I've heard anybody say that that should be the standard. I think before you plead willfulness, I think you should certainly have knowledge, be able to plead with some certainty that the patentee had knowledge of, the accused infringer had knowledge of the patent before they commenced their infringing activity or that they continued their infringing activity after having knowledge of it. And I think as long as the patentee feels, you know, has an objectively strong position, I don't think that opinions beforehand are likely to assist it in this matter or likely to be coming into play.
Will we be seeing more detailed cease and desist letters laying out the grounds for infringement in order to meet that first part of the Seagate test, to show the accused infringer that they are objectively infringing?
Yeah. Well, you know, people could certainly do that. But again, I would look at that as sort of the tail wagging the dog again. You know, willfulness has always been hard to prove. It's even harder to prove now. And sometimes even though you prove it, you don't benefit from it at all because it's left to the judge's discretion about whether he's going to do anything about it and award enhanced damages. So I think you have to look at every situation, and there may be it may be the case that you don't want to lay out for your potential opponent the blueprint for your case just on the chance that it might be a good piece of evidence later on to help your willfulness argument.
In terms of willful infringement that is occurring after the litigation has commenced, I believe the court in the Seagate case said that plaintiffs should consider bringing preliminary injunctions to deal with whether or not damages for willful infringement should be granted for conduct after filing the lawsuit.
What they said that when an accused infringer's conduct post-filing of the litigation is reckless, that the patentee's recourse for that is to move for a preliminary injunction, and that would provide an adequate remedy for combating post-filing willful infringement, and seems to suggest that unless you do that, then you really can't come to the court and say, look, I want treble damages or enhanced damages for their reckless conduct after I filed this lawsuit. That's dicta in this decision, and I haven't seen it picked up in any other decision. Maybe the particular circumstance hasn't arisen. It's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. I had not seen that adopted in any case. And I think a lot of people thought that was a little bit a difficult concept because the standard for preliminary injunction is based more on just the merits of the case. It's based on things like harm to the plaintiff, public interest, and the like. So a preliminary injunction could be denied on a basis other than just the strength of the infringement and validity position. So I'm not so sure that there will be a lot of play on that point, even though it is brought out in dicta in the Seagate opinion.
So what have you seen in a post-Seagate world? How is the court reacting to it and applying the principles of Seagate?
Well, it's interesting. I haven't done any kind of scientific survey or anything, but certainly the Federal Circuit is sort of interesting. If you look at the Federal Circuit in calendar year 2006, it had three cases before it where it was asked to look at findings of willfulness. And in all three of those cases, it upheld findings of willfulness from lower courts. And in all three of those decisions, the basis for doing so was that there were that the accused infringer had gotten opinions of counsel, relying on opinions of counsel, or allegedly relying on opinions of counsel, but there was some problem there. So the Federal Circuit said, you know, even though you have these opinions of counsel, we're upholding these findings of willfulness. Now, Seagate came down, I think, in August or September of 2007. In calendar year 2008, there were five opinions before the Federal Circuit that dealt with willfulness. And in three of them, the Federal Circuit overturned findings of willfulness from district courts below based on objective criteria on the first prong of the test, that there was no objective recklessness. In one case, the Federal Circuit overturned and remanded a finding of willfulness. And in only one case out of the five cases before, did it uphold a finding of willfulness. And it was on a procedural basis. It was really nothing going to the merits. So we went from three cases of, yeah, there was willfulness, to three cases where, no, there's no willfulness, and two where it was remanded. So interesting. And on the district court level, as I think I mentioned earlier, we're seeing a lot more summary judgments of willfulness, summary judgment motions on willfulness. I'm seeing a lot more of them granted because the district court agrees that on the first prong of the test that there is no objectively high likelihood that the actions would constitute infringement of a valid patent because there are good defenses raised. But we're still seeing some summary judgment motions denied. So we're still seeing the issue get to the jury on occasion.
What is a patent owner to do on a going forward basis, keeping Seagate in mind, to try to ensure that they can collect damages for enhanced damages for willful infringement?
Again, I'm not sure that there's anything on a routine basis that patent owners should be doing in that regard because, again, I view that as the tail wagging the dog. I think what happens is you look at every case when you get it, and if you are a plaintiff in a case, hopefully you do have enough evidence that you can plead willfulness. Hopefully you have evidence that the accused infringer had knowledge of your patent and continued your activity. And I think you just have to, counsel has to plan early on in the case to get something in the record so that you can withstand a summary judgment motion, because I think they will become quite routine that before trial, defendants will file summary judgment motions and say to the judge, look, judge, there are a lot of close issues here. No jury, based on the record here, could find that there was an objectively high likelihood that our actions could constitute infringement of a valid patent. So this issue should not go to the jury. So counsel have to plan to get something in the record, be cognizant of this, get something in the record so that you can withstand summary judgment, because I think it's an easier argument to make to a jury than it is to a judge on summary judgment.
And in respect of people who are either trying to work around a patent or find a patent somewhere, what should they be doing to avoid being held as a willful infringer? Should they be getting opinions of counsel in every case like they used to, or what?
Well, I think that's an interesting question. After Seagate first came down, there were a lot of people saying patent attorneys are going out of business because nobody's going to need opinions of counsel anymore. And I think that was certainly an overstatement, just as it would be an overstatement to say that the standard is still like it was under underwater devices, and gee, you better make sure you get an opinion in every case. For sure, if I'm representing a defendant and willfulness is going to the jury, I really want to have an opinion of counsel, because it's, even though it's just the second prong of the test, I think that first prong of the test is going to be quickly discarded based on how the jury is feeling about the case, or considered, not discarded, but decided by the jury. And if they're already finding that you've infringed and they've gotten to the issue of willfulness, they're going to look, well, did you have some reasonable belief that, or did you should you have known of the risk? And if you have a good opinion of counsel and evidence that you relied upon, that's your best defense to willfulness. So the opinions are going to come into play less often because it's less often that you're even going to get to that second prong at the test. But boy, if you get to that prong, you're going to want it. So I guess my advice to my clients would be, you know which ones of your competitors are trigger happy for litigation. You know which of your products are important enough in the marketplace that people might go after them. And, you know, you're still going to want to try to get opinions sometimes on some of these. But you don't have to worry like you did before that if your research people are looking at opinions to find out what's happening in the art, that if you don't have an opinion on every one of them, that you're going to be found to be a willful infringer. It's still, there's no black and white easy answer here. But opinions of counsel are not dead by any means.
Thank you very much for these insights, Diane.
My pleasure.
My guest for this podcast has been Diane Eldercombe, a partner with the intellectual property law firm of Woodcock Washburn in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. For further information on Diane Eldercombe, the firm of Woodcock Washburn, the In re Seagate decision, and information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International IP Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.